This is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
And on the phone lines, we have a real live astronaut, don't we?
It's Dory Musgrave.
You're on with Chris and Rob. How are you?
Good morning, sir. I'm fine.
That's good. And where are you calling from?
Houston, Texas.
Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
And here we got really big mosquitoes.
What's the summer like in Houston? I understand it's just brutal.
Yeah, the summer's brutal, but it may not be as brutal as the Ohio winters.
Well, I already have, like, mosquitoes the size of robins down there. That's why they had to build the Astrodome, because all the Colt 45 players were getting stung all the time and getting their blood drank.
Well, probably close to getting it there.
So you're an astronaut, and you went up on Endeavour and helped repair the Hubble telescope.
Yes, sir, I did exactly that.
What exactly did you do?
Well, I was the payload commander on the flight. I guess the major work I did was getting ready.
That was it?
Getting ready ahead of time is when all the major work was, developing how to do that job. It's like telling the mechanic to change the engine on the car, adjust the clutch, change the disc on the brakes, change the oil.
A little more complicated than that. Did you get to walk in space?
Yeah, 3 times.
What was that like?
Well, it's a matter of floating around out there. It's floating around going 18,000 miles an hour, 370 miles high, and working with tools.
At zero gravity when it's negative 300 degrees Fahrenheit.
How'd you know that?
I read.
Yeah.
And you and another astronaut, Jeffrey Hoffman, replaced the wide-field planetary camera.
Yes, that's the one that looks out there a billion light years or more.
And we understand you had to kind of jury-rig something while you're out there in space.
I was closing the doors on day one. The doors that go, we had to open the doors that go around the star trackers to replace 4-8 gyros.
So did you try pouring hot water on them?
That was going to be a later idea. I ended up using a rig such as truckers hold their load.
Right.
Trailer with, but very gently.
So were you ever scared during the spacewalk or during this? During the flight?
I'm scared during launches, but not during the spacewalk. I'm really scared. I'm frightened to death during launches, but not during spacewalks.
I understand there's a 1 in 78 chance that a catastrophic failure will occur during a shuttle flight.
I think it's a reasonable number.
Don't remind them.
Are you going to do any more shuttle flights or spacewalks?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
When's the next one?
I don't know. I would guess around the end of 95. I'm not assigned to one yet, but in a normal rotation, I'd go again toward the end of 1995.
So what do you do when you're not actually getting ready to go up into space and have a mechanic change the oil?
Yeah, starting this month, I'll be the lead communicator, and that's the person that talks to other shuttle flights.
Wow, so you'll be the voice they hear.
Yeah.
When you guys get up there in outer space,
what?
When you guys get up there in outer space in zero gravity, do you kind of play around with your food? One magazine article said you guys like to play with your food and like to try to catapult it into your mouths.
Yeah, you do that too. Or you try to eat soup with a spoon. You know, and the soup follows the spoon to your mouth, so you get a string all the way from the dish. Maybe a foot-long string.
A string of soup, huh?
Yeah, it just strings out. Anything that's liquid sticks together. You know, it doesn't float off.
It's kind of like the blood in that one Star Trek movie where the guys came on the Klingon ship and shot everybody.
Oh, yeah. That would make sense.
Did you think those special effects were very realistic?
I didn't see that particular movie.
What, do you like science fiction?
Yes, I love it. And I love Star Trek, too.
What about the third and fourth movies?
I don't know about the third and fourth movies.
Well, in your educated opinion, what do you think makes a good astronaut? What traits go into the making of a good astronaut?
Motivation, energy, and attention to detail. If you want to, you know, put it very briefly, curiosity, an exploratory mind, someone that likes to be in a different physical environment, someone who's willing to work, someone who's willing to hang in there for the long run, through the good and the bad, the ups and the downs.
Now, according to your listing in the Who's Who, you are an astronaut, a surgeon, a pilot, a physiologist, and an educator. What I want to know is your head the normal size or is it bigger than most people's? How can you do all those things?
It happens to be bigger than average, but I'm not sure that's related.
How do you do surgery and also be an astronaut?
Well, I was a surgeon when they selected me for NASA. I was in the Marine Corps in Korea, and then I went out and got an education in medical school and was a surgeon. And I was a surgeon when I was selected to be an astronaut.
Did you ever do any experiments in space on what medicine would be like?
No, I operate on Hubble.
Oh, okay.
But, and it's related. There's a lot of physiology in spacesuits. The spacesuits take care of you. You know, you set your own temperature by setting a valve. The air that you get to breathe is what that back tank gives you. And the design of suits such that you can work in them. There's a lot of biology. There's a lot of what's called anthropometrics in there.
Oh, yes, anthropometrics, yes.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite temperature to set your suit at?
I run rather cool.
About 65?
Well, I run a water temperature. I run a water temperature down closer to 45, and that's the water that's flowing over very fine tubes that are in, they're in my undergarments.
How many times have you been up in the space shuttle?
5 times.
What's your favorite part about going to outer space?
Spacewalks, I think, is a very nice part. But the other thing is playing with the magic of zero-G, like you can sleep floating around and looking out the window. I love to look at Earth from out there.
I've heard it's really pretty.
It's extraordinarily pretty in all different kinds of ways, the things you can see. You can see little islands being born in the Pacific, around the Pacific Rim. You know, you can see just the lava, volcanoes, just lava and steam coming out. And maybe you can see it just a little tip of the volcano starting to push out of the sea surface. You can see the Namib Desert in Africa, where you got 150 miles of dunes that are 2,000 feet tall. That's sand dunes that are as tall as a 200-story building. And they run right up to the ocean. So you got 150 miles of desert, and then you got the ocean. You know, you got waves of water and waves of sand and all that kind of stuff. You got the Blue Bahamas.
I've heard you can even still see the trenches in France from World War I.
I don't know. I have very little France time from space.
What happens when you look out at space? Can you see planets any better than you can from Earth, or comets or anything cool like that?
Yes. But it's like being in your living room. You need to dark adapt and turn all the lights off and get your nose on the window. And then you see a lot more stars.
Wow.
A lot brighter stars and a lot more. But what's really neat is looking at city lights. Like the U.S. Last time, every time I went over the U.S., it was at night. And you could see the entire United States on 370 miles. Even before I got to San Diego, I could see Boston.
Wow.
And you see the big outline of all the city lights. And you see the interstate highways that connect them.
What's Cincinnati look like?
I saw Cincinnati. Looks nice. It's not as bright as Las Vegas.
Have you ever launched any covert spy satellites that have been eating at your conscience and you'd like to confess now?
No, I'll make no confessions. I was on 2 Department of Defense flights. One of them was semi-classified, the other one was totally classified.
What'd you do on the totally classified one?
That's funny.
When Mr. and Mrs. Musgrave were picking out names for their son, how did they come up with Story?
Oh, that Mr. and Mrs. Musgrave.
Yeah.
Right.
Story was the last name a couple generations back. So it wasn't the first name back then, it was the last name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they just turned their first name, but I love it. What do you think of it?
I think it's cool.
Yeah.
There's not too many guys named Story out there. So, I'm named Rob. So if I'm in a crowded room, somebody says, "Hey, Rob," 8 heads turn. But if somebody says, "Hey, Story," you're probably the only head that turns.
Yeah, well, I haven't known too many Robs either.
Must be a Midwest thing.
Oh.
Have you ever seen any aliens while you're in space or any...
Yeah, I spent time in Ohio. I graduated from Marietta College down there in the river.
All right. You also went to University of Kentucky.
Yeah, that's nearby.
In UCLA.
Yeah.
In Columbia.
Yeah, Marietta was special. All the brick streets and the elm trees and in the juncture of the Muskingum in Ohio. That was really nice. It was a great education there.
So who do you like better, the Kentucky Wildcats or the UCLA Bruins?
Yeah, that's mean.
What? So have you seen any unidentified spacecraft out there?
I've been looking.
Have you seen any?
I can't say I've seen a lot of very interesting phenomena.
I heard... And I tell you, correct me if this is not true, but I heard that when Neil Armstrong came back, one of the first things he did was he was on the Dick Cavett Show, and he said he had seen a UFO, and then after that he was never allowed to do another interview again, and to this day he won't even talk about it.
I don't know about what happened to what happened to Neil, but I talk about those things all the time. And there's no suppression of that at all.
What's the most interesting UFO type thing you ever saw?
Well, there's a huge, when the engine shut off, there is a huge amount of debris and loose things out there. In a zero G, the freedom, everything goes its own way, and they all go in different directions. And if you're in sunlight, you know, and you're looking at these things against the dark blackness, those things are like bright little stars. They're like little lasers as they turn, and they got their own little rotation rates. And so as they go away from the spacecraft, hundreds of yards or miles, you've got a pile of stuff out there which is talking at you, and it's a little dance. It's like a celestial dance, these particles. And twice I saw a snake out there. What I call the snake, it's about a 6 or 7 foot long eel that is swimming out there. And I mean, I know it is a piece of ceiling or something. People hardly believe me, but I says, hey, go check my videos. I got it on camera.
Well, if you'd like to send us a video, we'd love to see it.
But it's my snake. It's like an eel swimming out there. And presumably, it's a rubber seal. And it's not significant because I keep telling people about it, and nothing's wrong with the shuttles. You know, they fix them. They refurbish them between flights. But I'm just saying there are phenomena like that that occur. On my last flight, I got a video of a meteorite coming in underneath. You know, the meteorites, the shooting stars that come in,
right?
They don't come in up above you. The atmosphere is below you, so they come in below you. And I got one of those on video. It's a spectacular thing. You're just glad that they went underneath.
Maybe you should take Jim from the old Marlon Perkins show. Maybe he can grab that eel for you.
Yeah. But those things do happen out there.
Now, before Chris and Rob called you to do our talk show, you've done some other big national talk shows, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, I was on a... Ted Koppel interviewed me when I was in space. I was on the Tonight Show. I'm going to be on 60 Minutes here.
Really?
Early. Yeah.
What are they going to be talking about on 60 Minutes?
Well, we just did the segment interview. We spent about 5 hours working on this. You know how that works. A segment producer gets to know you real well, explores a lot of topics, and then gives a focus to what it's going to be on. You know, picks out interesting things to build a theme. So I'm not sure yet how that'll go.
Which guy from 60 Minutes got to interview you?
It'll be Mike Wallace.
Wow. He's a good one. Did he rake yet? Did he put you over the coals?
No, but I haven't done him yet. I've only been with a segment producer who's Bob Anderson.
Find out what kind of hair dye Mike Wallace uses. In case I ever go gray, I'd like to latch on to that.
Get back with us.
A hair dye.
Yeah, Mike uses some serious dye.
You know, I need to have some. I don't have any hair to dye, but maybe I could put something on the skin.
Well, so what's Ted Koppel like up close and personal?
Well, I wasn't very close because I was in space, but I thought it was a marvelous interview. I thought it was a great interview.
What was it like being on the Tonight Show?
I like Jay Leno. He's very personable. He looks in the eye. He talks to you. He comes by ahead of time to get to know you. And he's very sincere.
Who else was on the show the same night?
Jack Lemmon.
Really?
And he's a marvelous man, too. He was very friendly.
You know him?
Very authentic person. I like Jack.
You do?
I've always liked him, but never knew him until I met him there.
You did? What did you talk to him about?
Well, what would be the benefits of a space station?
Well, a space station is one alternative. It's, you can talk about practical things. You can talk about doing astronomy, looking outward. You can talk about studying the Earth from there. You can talk about materials processing. You can talk about assembling planetary missions. But it is one alternative in humanity's quest for, you know, for what space is. Space is basically humanity's reach outward to find out, to give themselves meaning for their current life on Earth.
It's also the final frontier.
Yeah. It's all those kinds of things. And space station is one of the alternatives. It's a logical alternative. We might have done it even earlier before going to the moon. But it is one alternative. It's a reasonable one, but it has to be done correctly.
We kind of talked about Neil Armstrong a little bit. How do those older guys, those right stuff kind of guys, get along with you young whippersnappers? Is there any of this kind of, well, I remember back when I was doing this stuff, we didn't have all these fancy schmancy safety precautions. Is there any of that kind of stuff?
Well, Neil's my generation, you know. I was in this program with him at the same time. We were friends. We shared a room, an office. And Neil and Neil tends to be more private, but Buzz and Mike were also my generation.
Did Neil ever tell you about that UFO he told Dick Cavett about?
No, didn't happen to.
Did you ever meet Ohio Senator John Glenn?
Yes.
What kind of man is he?
I think he's exactly the way he came across. You know, that's one thing the right stuff did. It did a fairly good character portrayal of people. It was kind of a...
The movie or the book or both?
Both. And, you know, Tom Wolfe interviewed me for 8 hours.
Was he wearing a white suit? Every time I see Tom Wolfe, he's wearing a white suit.
No, he wasn't in a white suit then.
Oh, okay. And what'd you guys talk about for 8 hours?
He talked about the space program, but, you know, he was getting a sort of a different tone. He chose to do that slice on Edwards. He had the entire picture up till 1973, and so he didn't deal in Apollo. He didn't deal in Gemini. He barely dealt in Mercury. But what was interesting was he had the whole thing. He had gathered all that information, and he chose a very small slice, and that is the Edwards community, basically, with very little of the Mercury program.
His book was still pretty hefty, though.
Yes.
So maybe...
But he chose what part. And what was interesting was he didn't write it until 12 years after he gathered the information.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, because I knew when I interviewed him, and I knew when the book came out. But he does a great interview. I mean, he's penetrating. He goes after details.
What could you tell young people today who would like to grow up and become an astronaut?
I think the most important thing to do is to follow your heart and follow your dreams, to do what turns you on. You got to follow your passions or you're not going to have the energy and you're not going to do things well. You got to have passion in what you do.
You'd be good on career day at school.
Yeah. But it helps, you know, to do some things that relate, such as astronomy, physics, geology.
Or being a surgeon.
Medicine, yeah. Engineering. But you can bend things. You can do, I'd say, almost any discipline and have it contribute to space. The most important thing is you got passion in it.
You're, what, 58 years old?
Yeah.
When are you going to slow down? When is Story going to hang up the spacesuit?
Well, I haven't found a... life is getting better all the time so far. I haven't...
And Chris and Rob is the apex.
Is that... Yeah. Well, I hope it's a plateau. You know? I hope it's not an apex. That means I'm going down from here.
Hopefully you can cruise at this altitude for a while.
Yeah, I hope I can cruise right here at the Chris and Rob level.
What do you do to relax? How does Story Musgrave unwind?
Well, I talk to you guys. I'm not sure I need to relax because I love my work. It's a calling. You know, it's not a job. It's a kind of calling. And for me, there is no off the job and on the job. I have one heart and I have one soul. And it's the same person off the job as on. And so no matter what I do, it is the same person. And and I'm integrating pleasure and work.
Now, there are rumors. Okay, you go ahead.
Well, I like getting in suits. I like getting in space suits and getting in the water tanks and the vacuum chambers. I like to mess with suits. I love to go flying. I like simulators.
What is that like? That you did 400 hours of underwater training preparing for the last space shuttle flight.
Yeah.
What's that underwater training like, and how closely to space does it simulate?
It's a little bit like scuba diving, except you get in a suit and then you hang all the weights on the suit, so you don't sink to the bottom of the tank, you don't float to the top, and you don't rotate like a fish, you know, it's going over on its belly or something. And that allows you to study reach and visibility. It allows you to get in the right body position, like upside down or something, to approach a workstation. It lets you practice working with a suit and let you and the suit become a new organism. In other words, it's not just a set of clothes you put on, because the suit really restricts your ability to move. You have to learn how to move in a suit. You get those kind of things. But it's much more stable in zero-g. Because, you know, moving a canoe paddle through water is a lot of force. You move a big suit through water, there's a huge amount of force to move it. And out in zero-g, there's no resistance at all. So there are differences. And the mechanism you're dealing with, you're not dealing with real flight instruments in the water tank. And so you have to practice with the real instruments in a clean room. But you learn the mechanisms there. When you go in the water, as soon as you start turning the bolt in there, you imaginatively tell yourself, the real mechanism I'm going to be turning is what I felt in the clean room. And that moving things, moving the big instruments, like the wide field planetary camera, that is, and the telephone booth, the CoStar is as big as a telephone booth. you push those things around in water, it's hundreds of pounds of force. But in the real thing, it's only fingertip, it's ounces. You learn that on the air-bearing floor. It's like saying in a telephone booth, you got to move around, it's on a skateboard. It's three-dimensional, and you're on a skateboard. And all you do is practice moving those things around with just ounces of force. So when you get in the water and do that, you have to tell yourself, this is not the way it's really going to be. It's going to be the way I remember on the air-bearing floor. So you have to mentally pull all those things together, and now you build a ballet that you're going to do upstairs. And then you work toward a final dress rehearsal, which only in your imagination is the total picture. And we nailed it right. We got it right for home. We had very few surprises up there. We went out the door and did it the way we imagined it would be, and it came out that way.
Well,
it's not like other NASA simulators, and it can fool people. There are NASA simulators which are so good, you simply fly the simulator, and then you go and do the shuttle exactly like that, and that's the way it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
For spacewalking, there is no simulator. There's a whole series of them. But there is no hi-fi simulator which covers everything. It's only in your imagination that you build, that you rehearse how it's going to be upstairs.
Did the spokespeople for NASA hype up the difficulty of the last mission so when you guys pulled it off that it would make NASA look that much better, or was it truly as difficult as the spokespeople let on?
I think it was incredibly ambitious. I'm not sure it was that difficult. I do not think the NASA community, nor the Hubble community, nor the scientists, I don't think anybody expected us to pull it off. I thought the probabilities were incredibly slim that we would do on every single day what we had planned to do on every day ahead of time. So I don't think the difficulty was hyped. I expected to run into surprises which would be showstoppers. I personally expected that. And I had people trained for surprise. And I was planning on surprises that would stop us in our tracks. We'd go on to some other work, research that, and come back the next day to try to get it done. I did not expect it to go this well myself.
Well, when it went that well, and you put on the WFPC, and everything else went fine, and you were coming back into Earth, what was the feeling like knowing that you hit one out of the park?
I never had a celebration of victory. I still haven't. I have never celebrated this. I can't let go of this thing. You know, I'd like to go back in 97, and Hubble's not done. It's like your kid just graduated high school. Yes, and you're certainly, you know, you're very grateful to be there, but it's not over. And so for some reason, I have never had a victory celebration. But I'm a long-term investor in all this, you know.
Right.
That's my calling. There's more to come.
Have you ever been on the space shuttle and, you know, you're there with the other six astronauts or so, and you just said, hey, guys, screw this. Let's go to the moon. And just decide, have you ever been tempted to go somewhere where you really wanted to go and not do what you were sent up there to do?
No. I just light the engines and go somewhere.
You know, like when you take off for a trip and you think you want to go to Miami Beach, and you say, nah, let's go to...
You're not getting any further than we did.
No.
370, 400 miles as far as you're going.
What do you hope to see in the future for NASA and the space program?
Well, I hope to see a leaner and meaner space program. I hope to see a space program in which programs, once they get instituted, they happen faster. I don't like 12 years. I think 12 years is too long between the onset of some project and the completion, the fruition of the project. I would like to see, you know, leaner and meaner management and accountability. I would like to see us get more done for the amount of money that we have. I would like to see a more reliable and a lower cost access to space.
How come it's been so long since somebody's been to the moon, and would you like to go sometime soon?
Going back to the moon, I look upon space flight as kind of like a tree. You got roots that are the basic motivations, and that is the human quest for what they're put. The basic motivations are, is humanity after its place in the universe, starting, you know, back in Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and those people. It's to find out what the universe is all about, what our place is, and what it means to be human. You know, what our future as a species is, and all those kind of big questions. Those are the roots which drive this tree. Now, a little limb might be a Mercury program, another limb would be Gemini, another little branch would be Apollo. Then you got the unmanned programs, like the Viking programs and those kind of things. And the tree you might look upon as exploration. Now, space station is one of those limbs. Going back to the moon is another little limb. All of these kind of limbs are alternatives, which are useful at the time, but you could pick any one of them, and they could be fruitful programs. Now, going back to the moon, yeah, that's another good thing to do. I think the key issue there is, though, can you mine lunar materials? If you want to set up a colony, if you want to set up an observatory there, the first thing you have to develop is how you mine the materials. Can you get oxygen out of the moon? Can you build your colony out of lunar materials? If you can't do that, the transportation of things out there is fantastically expensive, you see, and then you have to look at that. Is that worthwhile? But if you develop a mining capability where you can manufacture your colony and get oxygen and other materials you need from the moon itself, then it's a different ballgame.
What about the Mars probe? Do you think it's really lost, or do you think that NASA just doesn't want us to see the pictures it's sending back?
I think it's lost.
Okay. Is there a face on Mars?
I think NASA's incredibly honest with the public. I really do.
Is there a face on Mars?
Well, it's like looking at a work of art. What do you see in it?
Like a big Rorschach test. Like a big red Rorschach test.
I do not think so personally. Maybe y'all could see something like that in it. It's like looking at a work of art. What do you see in it?
How will NASA handle the lightning strike mini scandal?
Now, which one is this?
That's the one where the people from NASA bought the piece of medical equipment that was a piece of junk, and it was really the FBI selling the medical equipment.
I don't know how that one's going to come out. It's unfortunate. I think there were some fairly well-intended people that got carried into that. But I don't know how that's going to turn out. Those are very small things, you know. It involves a very small number of people. But it kind of taints thousands upon thousands of people.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like a couple termites in the tree, and you have to get them out and start quickly.
Exactly. But I do know, I know some people that got pulled into that that were well-intended people. They were honest people. And you try to be open to ideas. Now, one thing you can't do if you're going to be a state-of-the-art agency is to shut your door to ideas that are coming in. And so you always tend any... you know, anyone on the street can call me up.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone can call me up. And if someone has some idea, in general, I will go talk to them. I will usually get them into my office at NASA. I won't usually, you know, go outside somewhere. But when someone calls me up and they got some idea for space research or something that could be done in space, even though they're strangers, I talk to them. But I get them to my office.
Okay.
So if someone on the FBI had some great idea for what you might use space for, and they call me up on the phone, would I talk to them? Yes, I would have talked to them.
Maybe someone in our listening audience tonight has a real good idea for an experiment we could conduct in outer space.
Okay.
When I was doing some research on your last space flight there, when you repaired the Hubble, almost every article ended with, "We won't know the results fully for at least a couple of months." Well, a couple of months have gone by, and so... How successful was the repair mission in December?
It was totally successful. Hubble's better than 100% right now. And they released that in really early January.
Don't make me look stupid.
What? No. They did. They said the optics are fixed. And we couldn't know all the systems we put in. As soon as we put those in, they checked the systems out. So we knew even before we came home, the systems are all working.
So I'm not faulty, the research is faulty.
Huh?
So the research was faulty. Time and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report all lied when they said that.
No.
Oh.
NASA did not want to declare. They wanted enough data to say that the spherical aberration on the primary mirror is fixed, that the corrections put in are working. They wanted to collect enough engineering data and enough images Now, I called them every single day. I called the Hubble Project every single day, even the day I landed. I call them, so I check every single day how the images were going. And they were going incredibly well. The checkout is almost done now. The checkout is still going on. But it's very clear that the images are perfect. Every single image they've gotten back since we put the corrective optics in, every single image has been totally clear.
Story Musgrave, astronaut and American hero, we sure appreciate you being on the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show.
All right, it was fun. I enjoyed being here.
Great, and if you could hang on to the line for just a little bit.
Okay.
All right, thank you again.